Internet addiction, gaming disorder, smartphone addiction, internet compulsion. Over 60 different clinical terms are used to describe an excessive, uncontrolled, or even dysfunctional use of the internet. But regardless of the label or the diagnosis, the problem is real and parents are worried. When does consistent use of technology evolve into an excessive or compulsive use, use that might require intervention even? As parents, what should we be looking for? And really, does it matter what we call it?
Hi, I'm Mark Roman, a tech policy expert and former White House advisor on privacy.
I'm David Reitman, an adolescent medicine doctor who works with teens.
We're also married.
To each other.
And raising a teenage son of our own.
You're listening to Their Own Devices, a parenting podcast with practical advice for the 21st century.
David, I'd like to put this discussion in perspective because the term internet addiction seems to be thrown around quite frequently. It appears in lots of headlines. And I'm really wondering, how pervasive is this? And from your perspective as an adolescent medicine doctor, how often and in what context did this come up in your practice?
Mark, this comes up every day in my practice, and parents are consistently asking me, is my kid addicted? He does not get off the phone. He is constantly has his face buried in a screen. And the truth of the matter is that these kids probably are not addicted. They're doing what they're supposed to be doing as teenagers. Every now and then, though, you do get the kid who is going to be having some more issues. One example that I have is a kid who had some issues with ADHD and anxiety and some depression and had some difficulties integrating into a social scene in school. So he would come home and escape into this world of his online gaming. Now, the problem was that it wasn't just that he would be gaming for an hour and then doing his homework and other kind of things. This kid would game for hours at a time. Occasionally, he would not be eating, wouldn't be showering on the weekends. Eventually, in this situation, this kid actually started failing out of school and had to transfer schools because he was not able to stay in a regular school environment.
So in the context of that patient that you were just talking about, do you as a physician diagnose him with some kind of gaming disorder? Is there an internet addiction there? It sounds like there were a lot of issues going on.
I think that in a situation like that, there may have been some addictive-like behaviors, but it wasn't truly an addiction. What was going on here is that this kid actually was struggling with other kinds of mental health issues, and those were the things that needed to be treated. You know, he was needing to be in treatment for anxiety, for his depression. Once those things happen, then the expectation is that the internet issues and the withdrawing from society is going to start to resolve itself.
Is it usually video games? Is that what you generally see?
Well, video games are probably the most common concern that I see with parents of teenage boys. I can also say that another example that comes to mind is when having to do with pornography. And a lot of teenage boys do look at online porn. But I have one patient, for example, that was starting to look at it on his computer around age 14 or 15. Within a year or so, he was actually looking at porn on various phones. Parents saw this was going on, and the mom and dad took his devices away. And then at one point, they would mention that they would go for a walk, and they would come back. And on their phone that they had left on the countertop, he downloaded 15 to 30 movies and hundreds of pictures. Just in a half an hour, they were gone. And the problem was he just wasn't able to stop. It was a compulsion. And I will say that at this point now, I think he's about 16 or 17 years old. He's still struggling with this. He has been in therapy, has not had a girlfriend, and this is just one where this became somewhat of an addiction.
When you were talking about the first patient and the excessive compulsive use of video games, you said there were other factors, right? He was already anxious, already had some ADHD and other issues. In the case of your second patient, was that also true?
This kid also had some ADHD, but he did not have any significant anxiety or depression. Although, you know, once again, a lot of times with teenagers when they're 14 and 15, you don't really know what's going on inside their heads. I got to give that caveat, of course. But this was a kid who otherwise, you know, looked like he was doing okay with the exception of the ADHD piece. And let me just also mention the ADHD piece for him was a fairly substantial attention deficit. This was not something that was just a, you know, routine, I need a little bit of help focusing type of thing.
But from your perspective and your practice, I mean, you have these two examples, but this is not the norm. These are extremes.
Absolutely not. Like I mentioned before, every parent worries about internet use. I talk about this stuff with my patients all the time. These are the two patients that actually come to mind as the ones who are the most problematic.
But what about the fact that even if you just sit with a group of parents talking, we hear stories all the time about kids having really hostile negative reactions when electronics are taken away, when video games are taken away. Isn't that some kind of, withdrawal response, or am I getting that totally off?
It's not really a withdrawal response. It is a situation where kids and adolescents who are typically not very good at regulating their emotions will go from 0 to 60 very quickly because of the fact that something they really, really like is being taken away from them. When you think of addiction, a lot of times we always think about physical addiction, and we do think about what is the body chemistry and how is it changing when somebody is addicted to a substance, for example. In these situations, these kids, when they have their phones taken away, they're not having intense vomiting and diarrhea and fevers and watery eyes. I mean, they're throwing a temper tantrum.
Well, we just looked at a study, right? The Pew Research study that was done in August of 2018. And of course, this is a survey. It's not like a clinical study, but I thought it was bizarre. Almost 60% of teens associate the absence of their cell phone with one of three negative emotions: loneliness, being upset, or feeling anxious. Isn't that a problem if 60% of teenagers are feeling anxious or lonely without their phones?
Absolutely, it's a problem, but it kind of makes sense. Remember, these phones are a major means of communication for a teenager. This is how they interact. So you take that away from them, yes, they're going to feel lonely and anxious and depressed. That doesn't mean they're addicted.
So what I'm hearing is that, yes, there are negative consequences or possible negative outcomes, but that is very different than saying a kid has a disease.
There are going to be certain situations where it will become problematic to the point where there is an extreme pathologic component to it. But for the majority of kids that I see, the majority of adolescents I see, this is not what we're seeing.
All right, well, let's bring on our guest, Dr. Michael Rich.
So for the discussion, we are joined again by Dr. Michael Rich. I think it's great having him back because while I see a handful of these cases, he sees a lot of them. He is the founder and director of the Center on Media and Child Health at the Clinic for Interactive Media and Internet Disorders at Boston Children's Hospital. But he is more widely known as the Mediatrician. Dr. Rich answers parents' questions about raising happy, healthy, and productive digital natives at askthemediatrician.org, advice that will be available as a podcast and as a TV series later this year. Michael, when Mark and I were first starting to talk about this podcast about a year ago, I actually went to hear you give a talk at the Society for Adolescent Health and Medicine's national meeting on PIMU, problematic interactive media use. What's the definition of that? Parents ask a lot of times, well, is my kid addicted? And, you know, I've heard about this PIMU thing. How would you describe this? Let's start with that.
Well, it's always, is it an addiction? And, and the first thing that I want to disabuse them of that notion is that, first of all, it is not physiologically addiction the way that, for example, opioids or alcohol or nicotine are, in the sense that there aren't physiologic changes that are measurable either when using or, more importantly, when withdrawing. There are certainly behavioral changes. But that enters the whole argument that's been going on forever about whether behavioral addictions are truly addictions also.
Right.
So we won't go there. The other reason that is that as a pediatrician, the word addiction is very problematic. First of all, in our society, we have kind of a bimodal thought about it. On the one hand, we're very glib about it. I'm addicted to chocolate. I'm addicted to shopping.
Right.
On the other end, we think of junkies in a shooting gallery or bums on Skid Row sucking down cheap wine. We don't think about our 10-year-old who throws a hissy fit because he's got to stop playing Fortnite and go to bed. Because children are constantly growing and evolving and changing, you don't want to put a label on them that, first of all, blocks parents from bringing them to care because they don't look like that junkie in the shooting gallery, but also is basically a stigmatizing word. And our response to addiction in our society is punitive rather than therapeutic. The other problem with some of the more than 60 names that have been applied to variations of this issue is that it usually names the device or the application. So it's internet addiction, smartphone addiction, video game addiction, or in the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the Bible of psychiatry, they call it internet gaming disorder and right. says it requires further study.
Okay, so what I want to clarify is you do not distinguish between gaming and other kind of interactive media and social media addiction, and it's all one, or you're saying they are different?
Let's take it back to the basics. We are seeing that some kids have uncontrolled use of a variety of interactive media, whether it be gaming, predominantly boys, social media, predominantly girls, pornography, which is interestingly evenly balanced between the sexes.
Really?
Absolutely.
And teens?
Absolutely. And younger. The average age of getting to pornography now is 9. Average age. Okay. That's the reality. And the fourth version we're seeing of it is something we're calling information binging, which is these endless Twitch or YouTube videos, even Wikipedia. Kids will crawl around for hours through the hot links of Wikipedia. And so, you know, first of all, I think that we're not seeing, you know, an addictive behavior, but we're also not seeing a device or application-driven behavior. We're seeing these behaviors that in the past perhaps were expressed as other kinds of self-soothing behaviors in some cases. In this case, interestingly, what we're seeing at the Clinic for Interactive Media and Internet Disorders, or CIMAID, as we call it, is one of these four manifestations, but in virtually every case, in fact, in every case we've seen so far, there is an already established diagnosis, not established in the child, but one established for the medical community that is driving these behaviors. For example, in kids with gaming problems, virtually all of them have a variation of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And if you think about it, this is self-soothing behavior for them because the world, the classroom, the playground, even the family dining room table is a much more chaotic environment, a much harder to decipher and manage environment than a video game that has very clear rules, is very circumscribed, they know exactly what to do, and they can get really, really good at it. Here's the other interesting things that happens. You can actually give the Connors scale, which is sort of the basic scale for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, to a kid before and immediately after they play a video game, and they will do better after they've played the game. In other words, playing the game actually improves their attention. It's transient and it extinguishes, but they actually are better at paying attention after playing a video game than they were before.
So we played around with some words, addiction or PIMU or other things. As a parent, do I really care what we're calling it? There's a problem, right?
I would say that I care that you think about it a certain way.
Okay.
So as a clinician that cares for your child, I care about it because I don't want to put that label, my kid's an addict, and there's a sort of a hopelessness attached to that almost instantly with that stigma. I care about it because I want this to be integrated into not just our care for kids who are in trouble, but to learn from those kids who've gotten in trouble with it and work upstream to primary care so that we are now able to recognize predisposing behaviors, predisposing conditions so that we can intervene early or even better, incorporated in what we call anticipatory guidance, which is that stuff that the pediatrician says to you about what you're likely to see in the next stage of development for your child, right? So that we need to integrate a deep awareness of this media environment in which kids are growing up.
I want to get practical for our audience, which is this. Okay. So my kid's got tons of games and stuff. What behaviors am I looking for to identify problematic interactive media use?
Uh-huh.
What am I looking for?
You're looking for when it is impairing their lives. You know, I'm online playing games instead of coming down to dinner. Or when I am asked to, you know, stop and go to bed, I flip out. And, you know, so you have withdrawal behaviors. And these withdrawals can get quite serious. They can, you know, just get into their rooms and lock the door and play. I got a phone call from a woman in Southern Virginia saying my son's been locked in his room for 3.5 days.
But if we're not using the word addiction and we are using the word withdrawal, for me as a parent, that seems incongruous, no?
Well, yes and no. I mean, then you get into the whole behavioral addiction thing, right? Is gambling an addiction? Is sex an addiction? Is shopping an addiction? Is chocolate an addiction? These are all things that we're going to show withdrawal behaviors from. What I'm most concerned about is, in the moment, is this child withdrawing from social interactions?
Okay.
Is this child not getting homework done? Are they not getting enough sleep, which is usually the first presenting symptom, is sleep? And are they not hitting their marks as a kid for what kids should be doing? Are their grades failing? We've had kids who were varsity sports athletes who just stopped playing, just stepped away because the game was more important to them.
But by saying that, isn't that a value judgment or subjective? Are the kids hitting their marks? One parent may think it's important for the kid to be an athlete. A mother parent may not.
Right. Look, every kid's not an athlete. It's more that they are pursuing with motivation and enthusiasm the things that interest them.
But what if that's the game? What if that is the internet?
Well, that's an interesting question, because there is now a professional video gamer career available to them.
And every kid thinks that's what they're going to be.
Or a YouTuber. Yeah. I mean, but if we take a decade step back, those same kids were the ones who are saying, I'm going to be in the NBA. Right. I'm going to be in the NFL. And, the odds of becoming a YouTuber or becoming a professional gamer are the same as their odds were of getting into the NBA. So the approach with that is, have a plan B, right? Make sure that you're covering your bases. Make sure that you're getting through school and stuff, because you don't want to be, a barista at age 52.
But comparing it to other activities, if my son is, let's say, decides to practice piano for 5 hours or play Fortnite for 5 hours, right? I would handle that very differently.
Of course.
But you say, of course. Why of course?
Because of our preconceptions of the value of those two behaviors.
Oh, but then now, doctor, should I be handling them differently?
Well, I think that's a question that you need to take up both with your child and with your spouse. First of all, you need to understand what Fortnite could be. Fortnite's about to pitch a huge competition where the winner gets $1 million, right? People will do all kinds of things for competitions where they get $1 million. America's Got Talent has sword swallowers and, everything in the book competing for $1 million. So that is a competition. That is a behavior. That is buying a lottery ticket, frankly, in terms of the odds of success. But I would also say to you that the chance that your child playing 5 hours of piano a day and their chance of becoming a concert pianist that can actually support themselves with piano is also a very long odds
proposition. But what about the impact on the brain? That's what I'm getting at. Is there a negative impact on my child from 5 hours all the time of a game or social media, whereas there's not that negative impact if it's 5 hours of practicing the violin or 5 hours of chess or whatever?
The right answer to that question is we don't know. We're engaged in a vast social experiment, an uncontrolled social experiment here. One of the research projects that we're about to mount, actually in collaboration with Sesame Workshop, the Sesame Street folks, is a global study of how kids are using and exposed ambiently to media on a yearly basis, doing a deep dive in their media use and their health behaviors, their health, their academics, their development, and coming back to them year after year so we can start to chart trajectories of, is what they're doing at age 8 affecting what they're doing at age 20?
How can you do research like that over time when the technology is advancing so rapidly? The fact is, the social media that you kids were using 3 years ago, completely different than what they're doing today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that is why we are using this idea of ecological momentary assessment, which is that we are following what's there in a descriptive way, not in a prescriptive way, as in we're collecting all the data and then analyzing it by slicing through it in various ways. So we can answer questions like, does screen time matter or not? You know, at this point, we think that screen time is not the issue so much as it is what they're doing in terms of content and how they are doing it, the context in which they're doing it. And that the screen time issue is more of an issue of what it displaces. It's not like there's some magic number of the right amount of screen time. It is, what are they not doing because they're on the screen? Are they not sleeping? Are they not doing homework? Are they not having a family meal talking?
So is there a point at which you can sit here and say, we need to make an intervention before it gets to the point of, okay, now we've got a problem. They're dropping out of sports, or doing all this kind of stuff.
Right. I would say that all of those parents who've gotten to the point of asking the question of a doctor, is my kid addicted? It's time to intervene. It probably was time to intervene a year ago. I mean, the earlier you can intervene, the more easy it is to redirect these energies. But I also don't think it's a panic. This is not get to the emergency department now where you're going to intervene. It is more of building an awareness in the parents and in the kids and building empathy in both. Because the natural instinct of a parent is to clamp down on it, to shut it down, to restrict it, whatever, rather than to understand what it is, what needs are being fulfilled by this for their child, right? And many of the cases, for example, kids who are heavy-duty gamers have never been diagnosed with ADHD, but end up diagnosed with it and treated with stimulant medication and breaking the PIMU behaviors, because they are seeking the solace, they are seeking the mastery in an environment that they can manage much more easily than they can manage the physical world.
That could be a good thing, couldn't it?
Sure, for them at the moment.
Right.
But what is it contributing to their long-term well-being? It's just like, you know, parents say, well, I put my kid in front of a video game because, you know, it lets me get food on the table and they're nice and quiet. Well, you could also give your kid an OxyContin and they'll be quiet while you make dinner too. Would you do that? Right? So it's
a matter of,
that's not a bad idea.
Not a bad idea. Okay, here we go.
But you understand what I'm saying.
Yes,
that I think that parenting is a series of risk-benefit analyses.
Right.
And parents have only seen the benefit of these devices up until now. And it behooves us to tell them what the risks are. Tell them what the both short-term and longer-term risks are. The short-term risk being homework doesn't get done, sleep doesn't happen. The longer-term risks, of course, mean that they drop out of society. And we've seen some kids with PIMU who look for all the world like a psychotic break. I mean, that they withdraw into their rooms, they don't clean themselves, they don't take care of things. They are very, very sick. It shouldn't get to that point. But in part, it's because we have not paid attention as a medical community and as a society to the potential health outcomes of these behaviors that we've done because they're cool, they're sexy, they're the bright, shiny thing, and they're fun, without a thought toward what would happen.
I'm having a chicken and egg question, which is that the kid who ends up in that horrible place, right, whatever you call it, psychotic breakdown, is the gaming a cause? Is that a manifestation of the problem that existed with this particular child, irrespective of the technology?
As we best understand it now, and this is a work in progress, because we've only been in a formal way treating this and researching it for a little over a year. In many cases, we believe that this is not, in fact, a diagnosis, but is what we call a syndrome or a collection of symptoms of the underlying problem, which is the ADHD, social anxiety, mood disorders of various kinds. And that in many cases, these conditions were subclinical, were not rising to the point where it disrupted their lives or impaired them in some way. But when they got into the interactive media environment, they manifested themselves. And so that's why we call it interactive media. We don't name the device or the application because it's the interactivity and that system of variable rewards that it builds in to social media, to gaming, et cetera.
So you're actually disagreeing with the DSM-IV?
Absolutely.
Ah.
Well, I disagree in one sense, too, that it's only one of the four manifestations we're seeing, right? But I also disagree with the nomenclature because it points the finger in the DSM as both a problem of the internet and a problem of the gaming. In the ICD, it's a problem of the gaming. The problem is not in the device or the application. The problem is in us. The problem is in our behavior with that. And if we can just say, well, it's the problem of the device, get rid of the device and the problem goes away. The problem does not go away when you get rid of the device. And here's a big difference between addiction as we understand it and Paimu. When you're addicted to heroin, to alcohol, to nicotine, the cure for that, if you will, is abstinence. Interactive media, you cannot abstain from. They cannot function in this world without interactive media to do our jobs, to go to be a student, to communicate with each other, and yes, to entertain ourselves. We have now entered a whole new realm. So the goal is not abstinence, but self-regulation. And self-regulation is really hard for adolescents because they don't have that fully developed prefrontal cortex with impulse control and future thinking and all those things that that brings to the table. So I think that we have to take a step back and not expect these kids to be able to manage things that they are not biologically ready to manage. And so, you know, when the 17-year-old wraps the family car around a tree and, you know, dad flips out and says, oh, my God, don't you have a brain? The correct answer is not that part. Right? You know, and you know,
can I call my dad? Because I did wrap the art car around a tree.
Okay, yeah, right. I finally figured out why. And you know who figured this out before the neuroscientists? The car rental companies. You cannot rent a car until you're 25, yep. Even though you might have had a driver's license for 9 years already. And that's because that's where the actuarial tables cross between the risk they're taking in giving you the car and the benefit they'll get from renting it to you, which is really interesting. You know, we spent all this money and MRIs and all kinds of stuff, and Avis figured it out before we did.
Can you give the practical, really, nuggets to a parent? How do we work with our kids? I know I don't think you like the term what I'm going to use, which is set limits.
How about we set expectations?
Okay.
Right?
Oh, sure. Take the positive approach.
Well, you know, you just got to deal with that.
It
with
is
me.
Interesting, though, that I go to set limits and he goes to set expectations. Law school, med school, I don't know.
Yes.
That's interesting, though. That is...
Right. Well, you work with the law. The law is about restrictions, right? I am a pediatrician who's dealing with nurturing a human being to be the best that they can be. So our jobs are entirely different.
Okay, so how do I do this with a house? Right. You've got your kids, you've right. got devices. How do we set expectations, manage this, and reduce conflict? Because isn't there going to be conflict?
There's always going to be conflict in a house. It doesn't have to be about media in particular. It's always going to be about anything. You know, that's how kids seek and strive for autonomy, is that they push the limits, they push the limits, they push the limits. But if you can, first of all, shift the focus from the smartphone as a constitutionally guaranteed right at birth and say, this is a powerful tool. This is like a power saw. Are you going to hand a power saw to a four-year-old because he says, Dad, I want to make a birdhouse, right? And when you do decide that your child both needs and can responsibly handle that tool, you do it with them. First of all, this is what being a family is all about. It's spending time together. It's solving problems together. It's being with each other, being present. And in fact, this is the biggest problem that I think parents have with their own devices, is that they're not present for their kids. Here's the thing that actually I say to parents, not just with issues around this, but with sick kids of any kind. When you're on the airplane and those oxygen masks drop, you put yours on first. That's not an act of selfishness. That's an act of helping, yes. being effective. The same thing goes for parents and for doctors, which is that if we're not taking care of ourselves, we're no good to anybody else. That's why I think it's important, not just from a modeling perspective, but from a personal wellness basis, that parents be conscious of their media use. I think that what we have to move toward in this realm is the concept of digital wellness, not just intervening on illness, but really thinking about how do we keep ourselves well in a digital world? Not pretending it doesn't exist, not turning it off, you know, completely, but being able to turn it off for periods of time where we can lower our hyperstimulation, where we can realize what's important. And here's the most important thing. We have to bring back boredom. We are so averse to boredom that we cannot get on an elevator or on a bus or anything without staring at our smartphones. And our kids are seeing that and doing that as well. Boredom is where imagination is born, not just because it creates the empty space in which new things are created, but it creates a certain discomfort that makes you want to fill that space. And if we are never bored, we will never have a new thought. We will just basically give our brain power over to whatever drivel comes over on Snapchat or on Instagram or on CNN. We will not be able to create anew.
Okay, so two questions for me that came out of that. So earlier we said we don't want to distinguish between online, offline because kids don't, but then we just talked about digital wellness, which is really wellness?
Yes. But it's including the digital space in that wellness. Wellness is not just about eating the right things and exercising enough and, you know, taking care of air pollution and all that stuff that we think of it as. We have to broaden it to our physical, mental, and social wellness in the digital space where we are spending, frankly, the majority of our waking hours now, right? We're not out in the woods cutting trees down. We're staring at screens.
I want to give a nod to parents, because you're one too, so yep. David too, is that we've had this discussion. You've offered, I mean, just amazing data and wealth of information. But, I mean, just listening to this, I feel this way, but a lot of parents feel that this is a little overwhelming.
Parenting is difficult. Deal with it.
Okay.
Parenting has always been difficult. All that's changed here is the influences and the environment on our kids. But this is an environment that we have created. And we have created it in a way that has allowed us to use it in undirected ways. And what this information, what this research that we are doing on an ongoing basis, because it is a moving target, is to give us the information we can use to adapt our parenting skills to that new environment. It's not a whole new parenting paradigm. It's the same paradigm. It's just understanding that we're in a different space now, right? And frankly, we're in a different space than our parents were, and they were in a different space than their parents were, right? The real difference here is that when it was our parents telling us not to listen to Madonna's lyrics or, you know, dance that way or whatever, our pushback was, yeah, well, this is us and you don't understand us. And here's the one thing to we have to be very conscious of. We cannot just sort of say the internet is awful or social media is awful or whatever, because all that does is it makes it rock and roll. It makes it that thing which kids say, I like that much more because mom and dad don't understand it and don't like it. How cool is that? It's Elvis, right? Things are always changing. And, you know, anytime we look back, we say, oh, wow, things were so much easier then. You know, kids were so much easier to manage. BS. No, I mean, we had racism. We had homophobia. We had sexism. We had all kinds of stuff that was going on that, you know, we don't remember in that kind of way that we are feeling immediately now with our kids. Yes, they are very good at what they do in the digital space. And that is in part because we have checked out of that digital space, assuming we don't understand it or can't understand it or don't go there. And that is because we have approached it as a toy. We have approached it as something sort of, you know, fun to do. And that's just the kids being kids, whatever. And then all of a sudden we realize, oh, my God, you know, they can run rings around us. And now we're worried. And we're at a time where there is what's being called the tech lash, which is, after years and years and years of saying it's no big deal, it's no big deal, all of a sudden we're saying it's all terrible, you know, and the needle swinging to the other end of the paradigm, you know, and sort of saying we got to get these out of the, because the kids are out of control.
But the tech lash also is aimed at what is now becoming more obvious and transparent, which are some of the business practices and behaviors out of Silicon Valley, where we now understand that it has been engineered to addict a kid or get them hooked on UI and UX creation,
right,
is to channel your kid in a certain direction to get more data and ads. And
right,
that's part of the
Okay, but that's not new either. I mean, people engineered Skittles so that kids would want more of them. Coca-Cola makes you thirstier, and it's sold to you as something that is going to quench your thirst. I mean, people sprayed nicotine on tobacco leaves before they made them into cigarettes. You know, this is not a new behavior to create what they call engagement with your product.
3 years ago, people at Facebook or Google would have freaked out if you put them in that list. This isn't new. There was nicotine. This isn't new. There was getting our kids addicted to sugar. I think what I'm getting at is the tech latch is about recognizing this is not new.
Right.
Some of those same objectionable practices aimed at children are now happening, but it's through social media.
Well, remember the seven CEOs of tobacco companies all with their hands swearing on the Bible that they didn't know anything about it? BS, right? I mean, and that seems, you know, oh God, of course they knew, et cetera. Same thing. You know, they knew exactly what they were doing, and they were creating a business model that exploited as best they could human behavior. And if you put it that way, that's what every business is doing.
Yes.
Every business is doing. So this is just our latest moral panic, but it's also not driven by evil. And I think that when we get into that values-based thing of they are evil for doing this, we lose sight of the fact that they were doing it for business reasons.
Right.
And if you want to call
it's
it an evil,
it's motivated by profit and shareholder value.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely.
But not what's good for our kids. That's not motivating it.
Well, but that's never motivated anybody.
Right.
I mean, even the Motion Picture Association of America rating system is not about protecting kids from what they're likely to see. It's about gauging what parents are likely to let their children see. And research we did a while ago actually shows that every 11 years, there's a full ratings change and ratings creep, because what that unaccountable, unnamed board of people are doing is not answering the question of how will it affect children's health and development, but are being asked of what do you think parents would be likely to let their kids see? And it's a marketing tool.
See, you do
it's
have not some a protective of my cynical, tool. You know, views.
It's not about being cynical. It's about being open-eyed. And that's why I say you build this on evidence, you build this on science, and you see it for what it is, whether it's ugly or not as ugly as people are, you know, panicking about.
Let's end on an optimistic note. So let's let you end the show with what you want parents to think about most or what you see in the future.
I think parents should not be afraid of change, not be assuming that the way they grew up and the things they did are the right way to do things. We need to evolve with the technology, not to let it take us away, but to learn how to use these very powerful and very promising technologies, but to use them to seek out the better angels of our nature, as Abraham Lincoln once spoke. And let's think about the fact that there are implications to our health, not just our physical health, but our mental health and our social health and our productivity, so that we can help raise these kids to be smarter than we were, stronger than we were, and kinder than we were. And when I talk to parents, you know, I sort of leave them with the thought that instead of developing killer apps, we should be developing killer bees. And those bees are be mindful, be balanced, and be present.
Excellent. Well, on that, I think we're going to wrap up. Michael, thank you so much again for joining us. No, this was tremendous.
It was great. And, you know, I'm resisting the urge to try and tackle your optimism. Let's just go with it. Thank you.
Another great conversation with Dr. Michael Rich, and we really appreciate his time in coming back and being on Their Own Devices. What I took away in a nutshell is that regardless of what we call it, there is actually a potential problem that we need to be aware of that concerns the compulsive or excessive use of technology, whether it's social media or video games or online pornography. There's an issue that at least we need to be aware of.
And I think that parents really need to also keep this in perspective. Most kids are not going to become, quote, addicted to the internet. But at the same time, if you see that your kid is spending excessive amounts of time withdrawing from friends, withdrawing from school, especially if they've got other issues like anxiety or depression, those are the kids that we want to make sure get seen sooner rather than later. And if you have concerns about these things, do make sure that you contact a physician or therapist to help your kid in these situations.
My closing thoughts are that media and technology is not necessarily the problem here. And what we're concerned about is how our children are using technology and how extensive is that use. Not over a weekend, not over a week, but are we seeing some kind of persistent problem over many months? But again, it's not the media and it is not the technology. It's the use by our kids. And that also tees up this idea that we repeat, which is we need to create rules in our family and for our children for healthy media use. Have conversations, discuss time limits, discuss what is, from your perspective, the appropriate way to use with technology and engage with digital content. It's not about avoiding digital content. It's not about having no devices. It is about finding that healthy balance for us as adults and for our kids. If you're interested in learning more about internet addiction or problematic interactive media use, then we recommend you check out the website at the Center for Media and Children's Health, which is cmch.tv. And then, of course, there's the American Academy of Pediatrics. They have a website, healthychildren.org, and that website has information on this topic, as well as many of the other topics we've discussed on their own devices. We think you'll find them both really helpful. Thanks for listening to Their Own Devices. This show is a conversation and we'd love to hear from you. Are you concerned that your child has problems with excessive or compulsive use of technology? Do you have suggestions for parents who are already grappling with this issue? Then please email us at hello@theirowndevicespodcast.com and we'd also love your suggestions for future episodes.
Their Own Devices is hosted and produced by Mark Roman and David Reitman. This podcast is part of the Podglomerate Network and is recorded at Clean Cut Studios in Washington, D.C. This episode was edited by Ryan Dan. Be sure to subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast app. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, leave us a review. It will help other parents find the show and get the info they need. We'll see you next time.
The Podglomerate. A Sonic Universe.